Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. What's up, guys? Happy Monday for our YouTube listeners and Tuesday for everyone on Spotify and the other streaming platforms. Welcome to episode 153. This is the April 2024 Instagram Q&A. We have a lot of questions to get to this week, so we're going to quickly push through updates and then dive right in. Can you kick us off, please, Brian?
Yeah, you know, it's tough that we have this rushed update section because we haven't done updates for like a month. So we will try to be as expeditious as possible. I did my Costa Rica trip. We did that through the end of March into April 1st. It was awesome. I would have a lot more to say about it, but I'm just going to focus on a few quick things. One is on the second day of the trip, I went running on the beach. I left my really nice Zero shoes by a log where I thought I would keep an eye on them. Came back from doing some sprints on the beach and my shoes were gone. So that was a huge bummer to start the trip because they were the only pair of closed-toed shoes that I brought. And so it wasn't so much that I cared about like the money lost or that I was angry that someone stole my shoes. It was more that I had to change my psychological mental perspective of what the trip was going to be because I was thinking I was going to go for like these runs in the hills and like to these beautiful views. And I was like, well, without closed-toed shoes, I don't know how much running I'm going to do, much less walking, unless I'm on the sand, because you don't want to walk for miles and miles in sandals. So that was a bit of a bummer. I was kind of down about that for a few days. And then I went out and bought some Tevas. And Tevas were actually a huge improvement on Rainbows, which were my only other shoes, because at least they had some support. So I was able to run a little bit in those. On the positive side, my son learned to swim in Costa Rica, basically, which is awesome. Because when he was one, we lived there for 3 months and he learned to walk there. And this time we went and he's six and he learned to swim there. We had a little pool next to our condo, like in our backyard, basically. And we were so worried going that we were going to have to keep this hawkeye view on our kids the whole time because they can't swim. And literally the first day we were there, Bryson just started doggy paddling and treading water around. And we were like, oh my God, he can survive. And by the end of the trip, I timed him to see how long he could just survive in 5 foot water without touching the sides. And he made it over a minute. So huge accomplishment for the kid, really amped, kind of a cool life story that he learned to walk and learned to swim in Costa Rica on separate occasions. What else? Overall, it was a really awesome trip. It had its moments of relaxation, but as many parents know, we went from having school and babysitters and all the amenities at home to basically being 13-hour-a-day parents in Costa Rica. So as much as we were hoping for it to be a vacation, it was a lot of parenting and, you know, to the beach to jump on waves and then back to the pool. And then let's do 20 minutes of iPad so mom and dad cannot completely slaughter them, and then back to the pool and then back to the beach. And it was just this round robin of constant activity. And it was a bit exhausting, but overall, glad we did the trip. Really great experience. I have a couple more updates. Let's stop talking and hand it over to you for a second.
So I have two quick updates. I know we're heading into North American or what I should really say is Northern Hemisphere summer. And with that comes the desire for to be in shape. So I do have some coaching roster availability, and I have a couple spots for typical, like your lower, shorter term commitment, summer shred. I really hate to use that term. Let's call it getting lean for summer. Just please pretend like I didn't say that. I've become the person that I hate the most. And then I kind of have two avatars that I would really, really like to take on as projects. And one would be like that intermediate lifter who's lifted for, you know, anywhere from like 3 to 4 years and really wants to push to that like next level of physique and is really looking to like dig their heels in it, learn and get proper guidance. And then the second would be a female who really wants to grow a butt and has been trying to no avail. This is something here. I just see so much really bad attempts of people doing things. And I really just like want to go help people, but I'm in some random, it's not a random gym, but it's a gym that's not mine, you know? So I'm not going to go talk to people and help them awkwardly. But for someone that does want the help there, I would really like to take on that project. And that would be very fun from my standpoint. So those really are what I'm looking for and have availability for. Second is I started an Instagram broadcast channel. It is called The Progress Squad. And you can find it on my profile. It has been really an outlet that I've been looking for. I've really kind of become disinterested in sharing a lot of things on social media because of the way that things have been going. And I'm not someone who likes to put things out that are not like kind of polished. And it just seemed like this. It's been trending towards this like gargantuan effort of production to put out Instagram stuff. And for me as like a business owner, I'm like, it's not really worth my time to do a lot of these things. Like I have a lot of other things I'd want to do, but I still like to help. Like I love helping and providing value. So the broadcast channel is my way of doing that. Things are not as refined and polished, but I just try and put at least a couple pieces of value or situational contextual things in there every day. So you will find that there. I would highly suggest joining. And those are my updates for this week.
Sweet. Yeah, I see people starting broadcast channels all the time, but I actually have never subscribed to one or have any idea what they're all about. So maybe I'll have to subscribe to yours and see what you're doing with it. Because as you know, I also don't love putting out content on social. I love stories, actually. I think the stories are a great outlet. And maybe the broadcast channel can be a kind of like a hybrid between having to do a curated post on the main feed versus more of just a on the whim post on story, which I do enjoy. So yeah. Cool. All right. So second update for me, a couple days after I got back from Costa Rica, we had the amazing Dave McConey come visit me from Brains and Gains podcast. It was cool because Jordan Lips came and stayed in my basement for N1 hypertrophy camp. And then 2 weeks later, I had Dave McConey staying in my basement for just a hangout and actually to go to N1. So N1 kind of is this cool hub in Boulder where a lot of people come visit and I get to make some cool connections. So it was really nice hanging out with Dave. We did a somewhat challenging hike on the first day where he was very unadapted to the elevation. So that was kind of funny to see our heart rates kind of compare as we climbed up this hike. And then we had a great session at N1. We hung out with Cass and did a back and pecs workout, which at some point, maybe I can discuss in more detail, but it included a lot of that kind of density that I talked about in the N1 hypertrophy episode, where we're alternating antagonist movements in a way that allows us to kind of keep moving and get more volume in. So that was pretty rad. And then we did a podcast with Cass afterwards and Nunez. Actually, I forgot to mention that Alberto Nunez was there for that session too. And then we sat down with Dave, Cass, and Alberto, and we did a podcast on the N1 channel that I think will be coming out here in the next couple of weeks. So that's pretty cool. And then literally we got back from N1 and we were all ready to sit down and eat food and just kind of relax for the night, watch some TV, whatever. And Xcel Energy, which is the monopoly of energy company here in Boulder, had purposefully preempted a windstorm and shut down our electricity. So we supposedly were supposed to know this was coming. They sent an email 1 hour prior to doing it being like, hey, we're going to do this. I wasn't on my phone. I didn't know that this was happening. So we get home and they had just shut the power off 10 minutes prior. We couldn't get into our garage door because it's run by electricity and we had double locked our front door. So we're sitting outside our garage being like, what are we going to do? We can't even get into our house. So we call a locksmith. Obviously, that takes like an hour. We're sitting outside being like, oh my God, all of our devices are like basically dead because we were just at N1. We were doing this thing. We weren't charging them. Kim was out at a birthday party. Nobody has any power left in their phones and their computers and whatever. We can't get into our house. Finally, we get into our house. The power outage was only supposed to last until noon the next day because it was preempted. It was like, hey, you know, there's going to be these really high winds. Let's make sure that no telephone wires fall down and start a fire. So cool. We're going to get power back at noon. Not a big deal. Not so much. The power didn't come back for 48 hours. So it wasn't noon the next day. It wasn't noon the following day. It was like 3 p.m. the following day. And so we had no power for that amount of time, really struggled to work, had to charge all of our devices in the car, sitting there just like running the car, idling, charging all my crap up. Quite frustrating overall, not the best way for Dave to end his trip to us, but that is what it is. And then final update for me is that my new cardio-focused program has begun. It started on April 1st, the day I got back from Costa Rica. So I've been doing a bunch of biking. I hit some really good rides, had two of my best rides of the year so far. And I'm leaving this Thursday, so 2 days from the recording of this episode, to head up to Fruta, which is in Western Colorado, some of the best mountain biking in the country. And some buds and I, four other guys, are going to go basically biking 3 to 5 hours a day with a bunch of grilling and drinking some beers and all that good stuff. So that's the plan this coming weekend. 2 times a week training has been great. It's been absolutely perfect to go along with all the additional cardio and biking and stuff. And it seems all like my recovery metrics and everything are on point. So much better start to cardio season than last year, where I was trying to train 4 or 5 times a week with weights and do all this cardio. Definitely find a better balance this time, and something that I kind of look forward to continuing with and tweaking as we go along.
I'm doing my best to hold in my questions about the power outage thing, but I feel like hell would be breaking loose, or should be breaking loose for something like that. But we'll talk about it offline so we can get through our Q&A questions.
Yeah, for sure. Let's jump into some questions.
All right. So this first one I'll kind of kick off. So it's a bit long. So in short, they really liked the Lyle McDonald episode, and they've been training consistently for so long, but have never really seen real change. They've heavily focused on the big five being bench press, back squat, overhead press, bent over row. What's the fifth one?
Deadlift. Yeah.
Deadlift. Okay. My question is, which might be a silly one, if I'm moving to a more hypertrophy or machine focus, can that negatively impact other activity such as hiking, biking, and the occasional game of soccer? Could moving from some of the traditional compounds to more isolated lifts negatively impact performance here?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's a common misperception from people often that think that somehow in some way these big compound movements, or the big five in quotes, are somehow functional and thus are going to have more carryover to athletic pursuits than just lifting weights and getting stronger and building muscle. And the reality is that, you know, there are certainly some movements that will be more sport specific. For example, power cleans are something that football players do because being explosive is very important to football. However, when you look at the grand scheme of this picture, being stronger and gaining muscle are the 99%. And then the 1% is specificity to your sport. So if this dude is just going out and he's like, hey, I want to be able to like perform and bike with friends, I want to be able to hike well, and I want to be able to play some soccer with my friends and, you know, not stress it out. I'm not a professional soccer player. I'm just trying to play soccer and not embarrass myself. There literally will probably be almost no impact from doing more pure hypertrophy training compared to strength hypertrophy with the big five. And the advice that I would give would be that beyond just getting stronger and building muscle, which will help those pursuits, is that if you have something that is more specific to that sport, that might help, like agility drills for soccer or actually doing hiking and biking, because doing the actual sport you're doing, being specific to that sport, is going to go further in improving your performance in those sports. So this idea that you can somehow hack the system by using weights in a certain manner that will have some sort of increased applicability to these other pursuits, I think is a bit of a fallacy. What is your take?
I mean, I agree with everything you said there, and I think you nailed it. I don't have anything to add to it.
Yeah, this one, I think we'll both have something on, but I'll kick it over to you to start. With all the volume studies lately and so much per session volume, are we ready to throw junk volume out the window?
So, I mean, the hard thing is how you define junk volume. My personal definition has been the exercises at the end of the session where focus is low, your intensity in the performance of it. Think about it as like the person who does their their push session with their bench and their other chest exercise. And then they go do three really half-assed sets of like cable tricep pushdowns that like aren't in close proximity to failure. They're not trying to progressively overload. They just hit their three sets of 10 with, you know, 70 pounds and move on. Like that's what I would call junk volume, because your intention going into it is just low. It's a low effort. It's not a quality focus or focus at all, really, on providing a quality stimulus and then progressively overloading that stimulus. So like that's how I would define it. And then I don't think from my standpoint at least, that the volume studies coming out would impact my definition of it.
Yeah. Or whether, like, you know, I guess the question is there a reason not to do these extra sets? Because volume has this now aura around it that you can't do too much volume. Because look, you can do 52 sets and you can still progress, like the Ennis study. I think the question might be more asking, like, is there an amount of volume that would have negative impacts on your training versus moving it forward or having a null effect, right? And so my thought is that it's important, just on a grand scale, to look at these studies and understand the context by which the studies are conducted, because a 52 set study is done, first of all, with, you know, 1 minute rest between sets or one and a half or whatever it is. And in practice, people oftentimes aren't training that way. So if you're resting 2 to 3 minutes between sets, you could probably cut that volume in half. And the equivalent is 26 sets compared to the 52, because you're resting more and getting more out of each set. Second is individual differences in responses to the volume. So even if you look at the individual responses of many of these volume studies, you're not going to see every single person responding super well to the highest volume protocol. In the tiers, you'll see some people respond better to 22 sets, some respond better to 36 sets, and some respond better to 52 sets. So figuring out where you stand in that spectrum and whether you're somebody that is in fact the person that responds to 52 sets might be the better question to figure out. So I don't think on a global scale, you can just say that like doing endless amounts of volume is going to be universally beneficial. So that would be kind of my first thought on, you know, refining this down to the individual. And second is, I think you still have to think about recovery. And so a lot of these studies are conducted on a 6 or 8 week, maybe 10 week period. But what does that look like over the course of 6 months, a year, 5 years? I think being a little bit more nuanced in the way that you assess volume on a global scale, but also for yourself, is really important to ensure that you're not doing volume that's just going to create more fatigue and not actually increase your stimulus.
Very well put.
Cool.
Okay. So this next one, I'll kick over to you first. Excuse me. When returning to an exercise after months away, does not starting at the same weight reps as prior indicate that no progress has been made, assuming that form remains identical?
Yeah. So what this person is essentially asking is, say I'm doing barbell bench press for 3 months, and then I take barbell bench press out and I go and do incline dumbbell bench press as my main chest movement. And I do that for 3 months. And then I go back to barbell bench and I'm not using the same weight anymore that I was on barbell bench when I left it. Does that mean that that no progress has been made? And I think it's, at least to me, quite obvious that the answer is no, because there is so much specificity to the adaptations of that specific movement. So you can't assume that just because you're doing incline dumbbell bench for 3 months, that skill is going to transfer from movement to movement. So there's going to be a multi-week period of skill acquisition when you bring a movement back in again that I think is necessary before you can answer this question. So initially, I would actually expect you to be doing less on the barbell bench because you haven't had that movement in your program. But I think that over the course of the next 3 to 4 weeks, as you reattain the skill of that movement, you should probably see your numbers match and then slightly exceed where they were a number of months prior, especially if we're talking about like an intermediate trainee, which I think this person would fall into that category, intermediate, early, advanced. You should probably see some sort of progress over the course of weeks after reintroducing the movement again. But going back to it cold per se, where you haven't done that movement for a number of months, I personally wouldn't expect you to be able to do exactly what you were doing at the end of the last cycle where it was a prominent focus.
Yeah, that's very well put, Brian. Something that to kind of piggyback on this question, everything that Brian just outlined there is a reason why I personally and for a lot of my clients like to run movements for as long as we possibly can to squeeze every progression out of it that we can, because there's that kind of overlap, right? When you switch to an exercise, there's that few week period where you're learning those, or not necessarily learning, like reestablishing those movement proficiencies and those sorts of things, where if you just keep the same exercise in for, instead of 6 weeks, say 16 weeks or 20 weeks, like you're not restarting that process over again as frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point. I actually moved question number 11 right now to this, to kind of answer in the same frame as this question, which Perfect. Was how long to stick with a movement until plateau And so I think you sort of began to answer that question. Is that kind of your idea here, is that you do want to stick with a movement until it plateaus, or what's kind of your thought on that extenuating question?
Yeah. So if assuming that all other variables are pretty much the same, I want to stick with it until we run out of progressions on it. And how to define plateau, it kind of depends, right? If we're in a caloric surplus, we have other variables that we can modify. Okay, lifts are starting to stall. What is body weight doing? Body weight's also kind of stalled. What is hunger like? Hunger's actually quite good. I still feel like I could eat a lot more. Okay, let's increase food. We increase food, we have a new stimulus into the equation. Those progressions can start to increase again as that body weight increases again. So it's kind of like a stepwise fashion. If we're in a calorie deficit, your progress is going to be slower because of the environment that you're in. And the difference with the caloric deficit, we know, and I believe this is part of another question here, but retaining muscle mass while in a caloric deficit, like the training stimulus is a large provider of the retention of that muscle, that stimulus provided. And if we at the beginning of the calorie deficit could do 100 pounds for 10 reps, we want to stay as close to that 100 pounds for 10 reps as we possibly can to send that same signal to retain the muscle. If we're just like, hey, I can't progress anymore, so let me just swap things out, and all of a sudden now your stimulus is decreasing, and because you keep changing variables, you don't know by how much that stimulus is decreasing, you're not sending as strong of a signal to retain as much muscle mass as possible because you have clouded your variables.
Yeah, no, it's super well said. I was going to actually take the exact same route. I love how you separated that into in a surplus versus in a deficit, because in a surplus, that should continue until a few weeks of plateau. Like I would say a lot of people hit a plateau 1 week after the other and they're like, oh, it's done. But like, you know, readiness varies week to week, day to day. So I would at least give it 2 or 3 weeks before you say, okay, I'm not making any more progress on this movement if you're in a surplus. When you're in a deficit, I do think, you know, you could go the majority of your deficit and not make progress depending on how deep you are into that deficit. And so ditching a movement just because you're there could mean you're changing movements every single week or every 2 weeks. So I do think it's important to increase your knowledge of how much muscle you may or may not be losing to keep the same movement in for as long as you can to assess, you know, hey, am I losing strength? How much strength am I losing? Or am I able to maintain my strength on this movement? And then there was one more thing I was going to say on this. Oh, yeah. The other reason, you know, that you would ditch a movement. I mean, there's a few other reasons, but, you know, joint issues, injury, monotony is one that I think has some merit, like given how we know how forgiving hypertrophy training is. Like if you're legitimately just not looking forward to doing a movement anymore, then that might be good enough reason to change it out, just so you kind of build some excitement to be in the gym. But in most cases, I want to stick with movements as long as I can and kind of see that through, you know?
Yeah.
All right. I'll kick this next one over to you. Does creatine really show benefits maintaining lean body mass while cutting, or is it all marketing hype?
So I think from my understanding here, it would be kind of indirectly. It's not that the creatine is like directly retaining muscle or maintain helping you maintain muscle, But because the creatine allows you to train a little bit harder, and this is a perfect placing of this question because we actually just talked about this, and because you're able to train a little bit harder or potentially get that extra rep, you're sending a stronger signal to your body for the retainment of the muscle that you do have. So I wouldn't really say it's marketing hype for creatine. If there's like one supplement that is worth the money, it's creatine, right? It's creatine monohydrate. I think it's really cut and dry. We have like 30 years of pretty decent research on it at this point. It's pretty safe to just take your creatine and not dig too far into it.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't really have anything to add to that one.
Okay, cool. Are alternating limb movements like dumbbell curls underrated? What are the pros and cons? And we also have a kind of second follow-up question that we're going to answer kind of at the same time. Does alternating curl increase motor recruitment given it's a unilateral movement?
Yeah, I think a lot of this question or both of these questions from different people are driven by Paul Carter because he's been writing a lot. I mean, dude, that the fact that that dude's following is growing as fast as it is with how aggressive he can be at times with people is kind of baffling to me. But he has been posting a lot recently about unilateral movements and how you increase motor recruitment with unilateral movements. And so one of the things that I know to be truth is that if you fail on a bilateral movement, like you're doing curls with both arms at the same time, and then you set one arm down and you curl with the other arm and then you curl with the right arm and you alternate kind of right and left, you can actually get a few more reps out than you would if you were just using both arms. And I think a lot of that also comes back to the bilateral deficit. And so that is something that we know that if you're doing a single leg or single arm movement, you can do more than half of what you could bilaterally. So the example I always think of is leg press. Like if you're doing a leg press and you can do 400 pounds with two legs, you can probably do 240 pounds with one leg. So that doesn't mean that, you know, you're necessarily getting more gains or anything like that. It's just that when one part of your body is working and the other part is resting, you are in fact increasing motor unit recruitment on the limb that is working. So I do think there is merit to doing single arm movements. Like you even look at the way Cass programs with N1, and he actually prefers single arm movements in many cases. And that's a multifaceted composition of different reasons. One being, I'm sure, this reason that motor recruitment is higher, but also doing single arm movements allows you to line things up better. So if you're doing like a two arm overhead tricep extension, it's harder to line things up perfectly than if you just set one arm up, twist your torso a little, and now everything is in the scapular plane and everything is lined up really well. So I think, you know, the combination of those two reasons and the fact that the bilateral deficit exists, it makes sense to me that there is probably some inherent additional benefit to unilateral movements, but you do have to weigh that with the potential additional time and additional psychological fatigue. Like that's one thing for me, especially with back movements. I know that there's a benefit to doing one-arm back movements because of the increased range of motion through adduction, as well as, you know, motor unit recruitment from bilateral deficit, like all of these different reasons. But having to go to failure or close to failure six times instead of three times, that creates an impact over time. So when I think about designing programs, in each day of training, I'll usually only have one or two movements that are unilateral and the other ones are bilateral. And that really comes down to the psychological fatigue for me, at least, associated with having to go to failure that many times.
Yeah, the psychological part, especially on like larger movements, think like the unilateral pull downs and stuff, like especially in movements where you're doing a lot of bracing as well, that fatigue does build up. Now, to kind of add a little bit onto the back end of the original question, something I really don't like with the alternating dumbbell curls, like Brian said, is the time, right? Because when you're doing from like rep one, each arm's getting that extra like 2 seconds of rest that it wouldn't take. Like that prolongs how long until you fatigue. So something that I'll do when I'm doing DB curls is I will do like bilateral, so both arms at the same time, to about like a 3 RIR, and then I'll move to my unilateral. So like I'll use the bilateral to get me close into that, you know, effective reps range where I'm closer in proximity to failure, and then I'll settle into the the unilateral. And we all know that those final reps before failure are where you're getting the largest motor unit recruitment anyway. So it's just a bit of like a time-saving mechanism to get you into that spot mm-hmm. that you know you need to get into anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. And one other thing I'll add there is just that one thing I don't love about alternating dumbbell curls specifically is that the non-working arm is still getting fatigued through holding the dumbbell. You're still using your grip to hold that dumbbell while your bicep is, quote, resting. So there is fatigue accumulated there. Doing a straight single arm movement is way different to me than doing an alternating movement where you are still creating fatigue through holding the off arm or off leg or whatever as you're using the working arm or leg.
Anything else you want to add on that one, Brian? Are we good?
Nope, we're good.
Okay, cool. This next one I'll kick over to you because you're the kind of leading resource here. Can you elaborate on the omega-3 index being tied to longevity?
Yeah, so just for anyone that doesn't know, omega-3 index is kind of like the HbA1c of fatty acids in your body. So while glucose is a one-time marker of, hey, this is where your glucose is at this moment in time, the HbA1c tells you how your glucose is over the last 3 months. So when you get a blood test, there is two ways you can test omega-3 or fatty acids. You can test them as a one-time snapshot, which I think is just your omega-3 profile, or I don't know exactly what the term is. And then omega-3 index is your three-month snapshot of, on average, how much omega-3 do you have running through your body. And so the question is, why is this tied to longevity? And I mean, there has been incredible amount of study on this. I don't even think it's questionable at this point. It just is. There is a Framingham heart study that has been running since 1940 through three generations of people. And they have shown without doubt that the increase in omega-3 index to keep it above 8% is optimal and leading to a 34% lower risk of death from any cause and a 39% lower risk of developing cardiovascular disease. And that's compared to the American average, which is 4%. So if you're above 8%, that is this increase, as I just stated. And if you're around 4%, which is the standard American diet or standard American, that is what that increase is in relation to. The increase in life expectancy from being 8% or higher versus 4% is 4.7 years based on this Framingham study from 1948 to current. So that's an additional 5 years of life by essentially keeping this higher profile. And the main reasons why omega-3 is so important is lower triglycerides and reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, as well as protective against cognitive decline. So you're hitting two of the five main ways in which people die: cardiovascular disease, which triglycerides are an extension of that, and cognitive decline, you know, Alzheimer's and things like that, dementia. So two of the five main reasons people die are significantly reduced through keeping a high omega-3 index. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the reason. I would really look at the Framingham heart study for kind of more information on that, if you want to go down the rabbit hole yourself. As far as me and practically applying this to my life, I have been taking 7 EPA dominant fish oil pills. EPA and DHA are the two forms of omega-3 that we care about. And through doing that over the last few months, I was able to raise my omega-3 index from 8%, which was already pretty good. Like, you know, 8% is that cutoff point where it matters, all the way up close to now I'm like 9.9, 10%. So, you know, 7 is a lot of pills to take. I think part of that is because I don't eat fish. So if you're somebody that eats fish regularly, especially the ones that are high in omega-3 content, that could definitely decrease the amount of pills you need to take. I know like Peter Attia has talked about that he takes 3 a day. But then if you listen to Rhonda Patrick, and we actually have a question on Rhonda Patrick coming up here later on, but she also takes an extremely high dose like I do. She said she takes one pill like multiple times throughout the day because she constantly wants these omega-3 fatty acids running through her body and being protective. So I think somewhere between 2 and 7 grams a day is probably a decent point, but I would probably work up from 2 to 7 if that's a route you're going to take. and I would test your omega-3 index every couple months over time so you can see where you're at. And, you know, why be taking 7 pills if you can get to 8 or 10% by taking 3 pills or something along those lines? Do you have anything to add to that, Aaron?
No. Right. I mean, I take my fish oil a couple grams per day, but I'm not deep into the weeds on some of the extending the latter parts of my life health quite yet. Okay. So this next one is over to you, Brian. Any updates on your Tongkat Ali experiment?
Yeah. So I mentioned on a prior episode that Huberman has been talking a lot about increasing testosterone through Tongkat Ali mixed with Fidogio agrestis. Is that right? Yeah.
Yep.
So I've been doing this for a while. You know, one thing that throws a little bit of a wrench into my experiment is that I did not bring these to Costa Rica with me. So I took them for about a week and a half or 2 weeks before Costa Rica. And then I went 12 days without taking them. And then since I came back from Costa Rica, I've been taking them again. And I have not done blood work, so I don't know if my testosterone has gone up, but I can say there is a notable increase in libido. And that's really all I can say at this point. So, you know, libido is a decent proxy for saying that testosterone has increased, but I don't think it's necessarily like you can take Viagra or Cialis and increase your libido, but that doesn't increase your testosterone. So I think that that's a little bit of a stretch to assume that. But I am going to continue taking it for another 2 or 3 months consistently and then go back and get my testosterone checked. And I will have an update for you guys at that point.
Yes, this will be very, very cool.
All right, let's kick this one over to you. Yeah. As an intermediate, can you still add muscle eating at maintenance, or is a bulk required at some point? And then I'm going to add this to the next question, which is very similar. It's longer. It basically says, given Aaron is in his gaining phase and tracking nutrition based on the conventional modeling, Aragon and Helms, for rate of gain, and we know Aaron's training is very dialed in, could he shed some light or color on this post by Jackson, your coach? I agree that we shouldn't make hair trigger adjustments based on a single week of data, but Jackson seems to imply an even less conventional rate of gain leaning into just eating at maintenance. So do you have any thoughts on that? Maybe if you want to go over the post that Jackson made really quickly and then kind of answer those two questions.
Yeah, I'll do my best to try and keep it all in my head on this. So there's a couple like really important considerations here with some of these things. And I'll try and break them down individually. As an intermediate, can you still add muscle eating at maintenance, or is a bulk required? We have some pretty new research coming out saying that yes, you can indeed add muscle at maintenance. Where I think a lot of people kind of mix their understandings with a lot of these things is just because something can happen does not mean that it is optimal, right? We could make the statement like, can you save money while still drinking at the bar Friday and Saturday nights? Like, yes, you can save money doing that. Could you save more money by not drinking at the bars Friday and Saturday nights? Like, yes, of course. You can build muscle at maintenance. Is that the way to optimize the maximum amount of muscle that you can gain? Of course not, right? And that's pretty straightforward. Now, digging into the next part of the question, which is, given that I am in my gaining phase in tracking my nutrition. So there is the Alan Aragon and Eric Helms model on suggested rate of gain for novice, intermediate, and advanced lifters, right? That I built a corner of my business on this, my muscle gain and fat loss models. We have the Alan Aragon and Eric Helms model. Actually, coincidentally, I built Jackson's model into it as well, which is a little bit more aggressive. Now, am I following the advice of the Aragon and Helms model? No, I'm not. And the reason I'm not is because I'm on exogenous testosterone now, and all of those models that are on natural base lifters completely go out the window, right? They're completely invalidated when you push outside of the population that they are built on, right? I went from 190 pounds in the second week of January third week of January to we're now 3 months later, I'm 215 pounds. I'm up 25 pounds in 12 weeks, right? That's what, 2 pounds a week, right? That's way over the model, right? It's way higher. Things change when the rules of the game changes, when you're no longer playing the same game, right? And that's really, really important to understand. Now, when it comes to Jackson's post here, Jackson talks about leveraging training stimulus as the primary driver of growth, right? Because we know that we get an increase in muscle protein synthesis signaling from training. We also get an increase in muscle protein synthesis from food, from it being anabolic, from the protein distributions. The muscle protein synthesis signaling from the strength of that signaling, excuse me, from the training stimulus to the protein feedings is stark, right? The training stimulus, it's significantly stronger. So what Jackson is effectively implying, and I really don't like speaking for others, but I feel pretty decent with this one, is that oftentimes in a build, people will use the, hey, I can just turn the food up dial as a crutch to reduce their consistency and effort in the training. And while, yes, your body weight will increase, but if your performance is not at least, what's the word I want to use here, linearly increasing with that rate of increase, that doesn't necessarily mean that the tissue is being added. Whereas if you really drive it via the training stimulus and your performance is linearly, or it's never going to be linearly, but incrementally improving, you can be very confident that you have adaptations to hypertrophy from there. So it's a little bit of don't let the food increases, or once, hey, I'm plateaued, let's bump the food, get in the way of making sure that the training stimulus is as optimized and as high as possible to leverage that as the trigger for growth, and then just letting the kind of food slide underneath to support it. So it's really kind of, you know, putting the horse before the carriage, you know, proverbially.
Awesome.
Okay. Did I answer that decently?
Yeah, I think that's solid.
Honestly, with this thing, when you bring in testosterone and PEDs, the rules of the game change, right? And that's something that I wish someone said to me 2-3 years ago, but it really does. Your rates of gain change, the things that you can do change, and if you can't compare one versus the other. Yes, the training stimulus and stuff is still important. The food is important, but you can do things when your hormones are super physiological that you just can't do when they're not. And that's just the honest truth of it.
Yep. No, I think you nailed that. So that's a good in-depth and I think sufficient for an Instagram Q&A episode.
Okay. I just talked for a while. I'm going to kick this one over to you if that's fine. Yep. Is it okay to rotate movements? For example, come back to one every 2 to 3 weeks versus the same ones every week?
Yeah, I think as long as you have some structure in it. I've designed cycles like this for myself in the past. I hesitate to do it for group programs because it can be quite a while before people get back to the same movement for diagnostic reasons. But as long as you set up a cycle where, say you have, I'll use chest as an example, say you have 5 different chest movements that you want to focus on, and you do one, or you do 2 of them in week 1, 2 of them in week 2, and 1 of them in week 3, and then you rotate back through and you come back to the first ones again in week 4 or whatever that is, I see no reason that really matters for hypertrophy. I think for strength, you have the skill acquisition piece, and it's extremely important to perform the movement you want to get stronger at, you know, specificity, the said principle. But for hypertrophy, I see no reason that you couldn't do this. Just understand that progress will likely be slower because you will have a slower adaptation to the skill component of the movement.
Yeah. So this is something that actually what I will use personally sometimes when I'll run like a program for a number of weeks, maybe, you know, 12, 16 weeks. And then instead of like changing the program, I'll bring in like an additional like cycle of days to bring in some variation into the program and also provide like another vector of stimulus, and then but still keep the same one in. So it might be like that would be like the example would be like a non-calendar week push-pull legs or something like that, where you might have like three iterations of push, pull, and legs as opposed to just the two.
Yep, exactly. No, for sure. And I think that's totally viable for hypertrophy.
Yeah. Okay. This next one, I love how it's phrased. Cardio destroys muscle?
Question mark. Yeah. So this is a bit of a naive question, I think, at this point, given the state of the literature, but I understand that a lot of people still probably are not as up to date on the literature as they could be. And if we go back 5-6 years, the literature did sort of lean towards cardio or concurrent training, the trying to do two things at once to be competing against each other, essentially to be antagonistic. I think the state of the literature now is actually almost an entire 180, where there is a certain amount of cardio that is beneficial to your strength training, that you need a certain amount of aerobic fitness to be able to not just perform your movements without taking excessive rest between sets, but that the increase in cardiovascular fitness allows you to do more volume, makes you more resilient to the volume, and it actually helps you recover faster between sessions because your mitochondria are functioning more efficiently. So I think there is a base dose of cardio that should be inherent in any strength training weightlifting program. But I do think there is a point where cardio does destroy muscle if it becomes your prominent source of exercise. And I think that that's something that I'm currently battling with and will continue to update you guys on over the course of the next 6 months, is that I've made this change where I'm now training cardio 5-ish, maybe 6 times a week, and I'm training with weights twice a week, which is a huge shift on what I was doing during hypertrophy focus, where I was training hypertrophy 5 days a week and cardio 2 to 3 days a week. So I think that 2 to 3 days a week is within the realm of what should be expected to optimize hypertrophy training. However, I think when you begin to push above that point, there are risks associated. Ultimately, I think it's probably going to come down to whether you are able to sustain your body weight. And my assumption is that if you can do cardio 5 days a week and lift 5 days a week, and you're eating 5,000 calories a day and your body weight is going up, I don't think you're going to lose muscle if your body weight is going up just because you're doing cardio. The reason you're going to lose muscle is because the cardio is forcing your body weight down and forcing you into a caloric deficit. So the question is not quite so simple to answer. There's obviously context, as there is in anything, but I do think, you know, most people would be benefited by having at least a base level of cardio 2 to 3 times a week in their program, and it would destroy your muscle.
Agreed. Agreed completely.
Cool. I'll kick this one over to you. Starchy foods giving a lot of gas and bloating. Tips for improving digestion.
Talk about the tip of the iceberg here. So I'm going to try and answer this in the most actionable way to help you. Convert all of your starchy carbs to white rice, right? If the gas and bloating dissipates really by a large degree over like a 48, 36 hour period, you are probably just intolerant either chronically or temporarily to one of those other starches, right? If you're able to digest the white rice fine. If you are not able to digest plain steamed white rice fine, you're still getting bloated and having gas, you likely have some varying degree of digestive dysfunction, and you need to find a qualified practitioner to help you with that, right? Or you will just go in circles and be very, very frustrated.
Cool. The next question. So this one is top fallacies or lessons you learned about starting a business. And I kind of don't want to spend a whole ton of time on this. I went back and referenced episode 142, which was January Instagram Q&A. And at the 1:16 mark, that's 1 hour and 16 minutes, we did a 5 or 6 minute answer on a very similar question on business lessons and growth and stuff like that. So unless you have anything to add, Aaron, I think I'm good just kind of referring this one to that episode.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add that I don't think we potentially covered there, it's much less about like the actions of starting a business. It's who you have to become in with like time management mode, yourself kind of motivation, and then your time preference, right? Because with a business, like you may do things, spend a lot of time for like a return you may not see for 2 years, You know what I mean? So it's a lot different. Like, you're not going to go to your day job and work for 2 years without getting a paycheck, but you, like, you very well may need to do that with parts of business. And it's very different of rewiring your brain, because it's just very different for how everything that you grow up with is structured.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Cool. Yeah, I guess I'll just read this question real quick. So if you were going to rewrite the T Nation article on strength standards for beginners to advanced, but with hypertrophy movements, what would the standards be? Any initial thoughts?
I wouldn't. I think they're not helpful. You know, I just, like, this is one of those things where I think that, like, handicaps people, and they start chasing these things that are not, like, actual. They can be proxies, but they're not, like, super helpful. For example, right, I have pull-ups in my program right now. I use some D handles. I have, like, actual pull-ups. You know how many pull-ups I can do? Like, fucking 8. Like, I'm not even joking. I can do, like, 8 fucking pull-ups, right? I'm quite large and jacked. I've been training for 20 years. I can do 8 pull-ups. There was a point, like, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I could do 18 pull-ups, but they're not providing the stimulus that I get out of these 8 now. And I just think it's, you have, like, if you do have, like, hardcore actual strength goals, then pursue those. But oftentimes these things, if someone really just, like, I just want to be jacked and feel good and look good, you know, with my shirt on or my shirt off, things like this detract people from what their goal actually is. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't rewrite them, because I don't think they help, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that this question is asked about strength specifically. And when you talk about hypertrophy, strength isn't the goal. And we've seen this a ton with, you know, people like Nunez, or with, he has a client who's the WNBF bantamweight champion of the world. And these guys literally can get so much out of 15-pound lateral raises that I think it would be wrong to say, no, you're not strong because you're not doing 35-pound lateral raises or something along those lines. It's, with hypertrophy, it's about what you can get out of the least amount of weight possible. And so it's almost the antagonist or the contrast to say, how strong can you be, or do you need to be? Because actually the person that probably gets the most hypertrophy is the person that can create the least fatigue by using the lowest weights, but still get themselves to work that specific muscle to failure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we could do a whole episode on this sort of stuff. I feel like these things just kind of confuse people and cloud people's understanding of what their goals actually are.
I think a lot of this goes back to Mind Pump, and Mind Pump has such a big platform, and they're so big on the Big 5. Like, even after that episode with Lyle, I had 2 people contact me and be like, well, Mind Pump says the Big 5 are the most important and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, the Big 5 are just not important. And Mind Pump either is putting out this message because they think they can speak to the most general population people by getting them to get into the gym and move weights, and that these movements, you know, they hit a lot of muscle, so hey, there's benefit there. I was talking to someone else about this, and they were saying that they think that Mind Pump has literally just dropped the ball on staying up to date with current research, and that they're still stuck in a 10 years ago time frame where they're promoting these archaic ideas. And so I kind of think this falls into that same category of just that things have changed, and our perception of what it takes to gain muscle has changed.
Cool. Yeah, really well put.
I have a really simple answer to this next question, so I'm just going to answer real quick. Basically, this person is asking, if I'm doing lengthened partial sets, which are something that I program regularly, and they're struggling to secure themselves down for, like, a pull down type movement, you know, where you can get pulled out of the seat and whatever, would it be appropriate to do a rest pause set or a drop set or some sort of other technique instead of battling trying to stay down inside this bench in this DIY setup at a Globo gym or in your home gym or whatever? And I think the really simple answer to this is probably to just switch to single arm. If you're getting pulled out and you're having to grunt and groan trying to get yourself into position for a really heavy pull down, and you don't have the thigh pads to hold you down, just switch to single arm. And that really is going to, you know, fix that entire problem. Like, you'll be doing 55% of the weight you would be doing with 2 arms, and you can use your opposite arm to brace. So I think that really solves that problem for you.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
All right, question to you. How to know when to give another macro increase in a growth phase?
So I'd say when hunger supports it is really, really important. So if body weight has kind of stalled, and what I mean by stalled is we have, let's say, at least 14 consecutive days where things are very, very tight and we have very little deviations between them. Training has also kind of stalled out, and that's at maximal efforts and intense, right? And let's call that, you know, one RIR sort of thing. Not everything has to be balls to the wall to failure. And you've been eating at that increase for at least 3 weeks or something like that, maybe 4 weeks. And it depends, right? There's the kind of coaches or people who will be like, okay, you know, we're at this level of macros, like let's add 30 more calories and you get like 7 grams of carbs or something like that. Like that's within, you know, rounding errors sort of thing. And I would not recommend making those adjustments. I would make them larger so that, hey, this change, this variable we're introducing into our gain experiment is large enough to elicit a change there. And then the big one there is hunger, right? If you're super full and stuffed and feel gross and don't want to eat the foods that you already do, and your body's sending you hard signals to stop fucking eating, and you add more, I can pretty much all but guarantee you, you're not going to be putting on quality weight if you do that.
Okay. Next question again to you. Do you think metabolic adaptation occurs faster with a larger deficit?
Yes. But it also needs to correspond with a large enough delta in body weight change, right? We have like acute changes in that are, you know, technically metabolic adaptation, but they're not necessarily what we typically categorize as the negatively perceived metabolic adaptations, right? Yes, the larger the deficit, the faster those adaptations will occur, but that's likely because the larger the deficit, the faster that you are losing weight and the more ground that you have crossed. If you spent 6 weeks in a calorie deficit, let's make it a little bit more straightforward. 10 weeks in a calorie deficit and you're down 5 pounds, right? Half a pound per week. You use the smaller deficit. Will there be some metabolic adaptation? Perhaps. Probably not to a large degree because you're only down 5 pounds. If you spend 10 weeks in a calorie deficit, but you're now down like 12 pounds, right? Or 14 pounds, 15 pounds, and you've obviously crossed a much larger delta, right? 5 pounds versus 15 pounds lost. That obviously implies a larger calorie deficit, a larger change to the environment, and very much likely a more impact of metabolic adaptation.
All right. We have a long question next. I'm just going to kind of frame it and not read the entire thing. But basically, the question is asking, have we gone too far with all this optimization stuff into the point that we're becoming fragile? You know, we're not able to overcome obstacles or be tough. For example, my diet wasn't perfect, so I'm not going to do my long run today. Or I didn't get 8 hours of sleep, so I'm not going to try for a PR. Is this not helping us overcome adversity? Or I'm not advocating for bad sleep or anything like that. But, you know, if we're not going to take our element before performance, does that mean we're not tough enough and et cetera, et cetera? Basically, the question is asking, are we extremely fragile and we're coddling ourselves by ensuring that all of these things need to be in order for us to do anything hard? And then he followed up this question with basically saying, you know, maybe it's not relevant if your goal is hypertrophy or longevity, et cetera. And so that's a really good point. That was actually one of the things that I was going to say in the answer was it really depends what your goal is. If you're training to be anti-fragile, then yes, this stuff is, in a sense, an unnecessary thing to focus on, because when you look at the SEALs or any of these elite groups that we have in our military and stuff like that, they are specifically training to be anti-fragile by getting 3 hours of sleep and still having to go out and do these things. Is that good for your long-term health? No, that's not good for your long-term health. It's not good for your performance either long-term. So I think figuring out what your goal is and then curating your recovery around that goal is super critical. At the same time, I personally don't, and I don't know too many people that are going to wake up in the morning and look at their HRV and be like, oh, my HRV is in the tank. I feel great, but I'm not going to work out because my HRV is low. Or, you know, I slept 6 hours tonight, so I can't go do this hard weightlifting session or go for a PR. I don't think anybody I know in the industry that is into training and stuff is actually putting that much of acute focus on something where one variable that's off is going to change their plan for the day drastically. Like an example for me is a few months ago, I noted that I PR'd my hack squat and I did it after a shitty night of sleep and like a long bike ride the day before. My HRV was in the tank. I didn't feel great going into it, but I was like, look, this is what I'm doing today. And I'm just going to show up and do the work. I did it. I PR'd my hack squat. Maybe I paid the price because I got sick afterwards. Who knows if that was from that process of events or whether that was just going to happen anyways. I don't know the answer to that, but I know that I would never advise anyone to make a snapshot decision on whether they're going to work out hard today based on one day of data or a poor night of sleep or something along those lines. On the other hand, if you wake up and you feel awful and you're like, I slept terrible, I'm really stressed right now, and I don't have motivation to go to the gym, then maybe it would behoove you to take that day off, put it off a day, get a good night of sleep, come in and have a better session the next day. I'm not saying you have to approach everything with this anti-fragile mindset. But I do think there is a balance to be struck there. And I'm sure there are certainly people taking it to the extreme where they do wake up, they have a shitty HRV reading, and they base their day's decisions on that reading. So all that to say that there isn't an exact answer or precise answer to it. It probably is specific to you, how you feel, and then, you know, what your goals are.
Yeah, I mean, as very, very well put, Brian. I think if I were to like really to provide a straightforward, simple answer, I would say yes, question asker, I do agree with you. I think people in the industry, I don't think so, no, because they are typically fortunate to have a deeper understanding of things. But I do know people who are, they're in analysis paralysis from things. And I would say I do think if I had to make a blanket statement, I think it does more harm than good for the most people, right? Same thing with like the nutrition industry, all the information now, people are as fucking confused as ever. You know what I mean? So I think it's a very similar thing there, but question asker, yes, I would say if I had to pick a line in the sand, I would agree with you here.
Cool. Yeah, I think I tend to agree as well. The next question asks daily supplements for a natty. Well, we did an entire episode on this question. So if you go to episode 148, which is five episodes ago, we did a whole episode on supplements. So I will refer you there for anyone else interested. The next question asks, it feels like Rhonda Patrick is gaining a lot of steam in the space. Thoughts? Aaron, do you know who Rhonda Patrick is?
Yes, I'm familiar with Dr. Rhonda Patrick.
Cool. Yeah, so she is gaining popularity, if you want to say that. I mean, I find it an interesting way of framing the question because she actually has like a million followers or something on Instagram. So she's actually more popular than Peter Attia, and she's up there with Huberman, maybe even above Huberman at this point. So to say she's gaining steam, I think is kind of like, hey, she's already got the steam, like she's already there. But I've been listening to her for a while, I would say a few years at this point. And when this question came through, I was just curious to learn about what her background and focus of study is. And so I think this would just be interesting for you guys. I went and found her profile, and these are all the things that she's worked on over the course of the last 12 years. Her master's, which was published in 2012, studied the link between mitochondrial metabolism, apoptosis, and cancer. Apoptosis is the death of cells. Her PhD postdoctoral focused on the effects of micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, inadequacies on metabolism, inflammation, DNA damage, and aging, and whether supplements can reverse that damage. She also investigated vitamin D and brain function behavior and other physiological functions. She did additional work investigating the role of insulin signaling in protein misfolding, which is commonly found in neurodegenerative disease. And she constantly speaks on the role of micronutrient deficiencies in diseases of aging, genetics, determining the effects of nutrients on a person's health status, benefits of exposing the body to hormetic stresses, such as exercise, fasting, sauna, and heat stress, as well as various forms of cold exposure and the importance of mindfulness, stress reduction, and sleep. So that is an extremely robust resume over the last 12 plus years of working in a variety of fields that focus on our health, longevity, and general sense of well-being throughout life. And I think she has a ton to offer, especially like what I've learned from her mostly has been omega-3 index based and vitamin D based. I didn't even know that she was as involved in some of this other stuff that I just listed off. But I think she's an invaluable resource for a lot of that. And she's kind of fun to follow because she just started really getting into, call it hardcore fitness, in the last 5-ish years. Like she was more in the, like she would do all of these things that led to longevity and health, but she wasn't super bullish on fitness specifically. And then she started this journey into cardio and she got super amped on doing high intensity interval training on her Peloton and stuff like that. And only recently in the last like 2 or 3 years has she even started getting into strength training. So it's a really interesting journey that's to follow her and see kind of the progression that she's made in her own health and longevity journey. And then if you look at the name of her Instagram page, it's called Found My Fitness. And I think that that's just relevant to what I just said, where she was focused on all these other health metrics and then only recently kind of really delved deeper into the fitness world of things. So just kind of a cool person to follow. And I think she has a lot to offer.
Very well put.
Cool.
Okay. This one is definitely not for me. So, Mr. Brian, is it better to have a second home in San Diego or Costa Rica? And how you would define the context around how you define better.
Yeah, I guess more preferred. So we've been debating this question, Kim and I, back and forth, because we want to get an investment property where we can rent it out, do an Airbnb or short long-term rental type thing. And those have been the two locations that we've been tossing around. So obviously my buddy here is familiar with this battle in my mind. Ultimately, we really prefer San Diego. And the reason being that it is a 2-hour flight domestically. So getting there and using the property would be significantly easier. However, as we began researching in and starting to actually look into getting a second property in San Diego, we realized that they are no longer giving out Airbnb licenses. So you can only get an Airbnb by buying a house that is already licensed to be an Airbnb, and nobody is selling those houses. So if we were to do San Diego, we would have to do long-term or short-term rentals, which would decrease the ability of us to, on a whim, decide to go, hey, we're going to go spend spring break in San Diego. So if our tenant is there in spring break, we can't use the place. So San Diego has kind of been put on the back burner, and we haven't done enough research yet to determine whether Costa Rica is a viable alternative, given that we're going to be 500 plus miles away and not really sure how that whole process works with management and all of those things. So short answer is basically we don't have our sights on any second home at the moment, and we'll continue doing research there. But I think San Diego would be my preference if we could get an Airbnb license.
How far is the flight to Costa Rica?
It's a 4.5-hour flight, but in this area that we specifically want to get, which is Santa Teresa, it's mm-hmm. the 4.5-hour flight to get there. And then it's a 4.5-hour drive from the airport to the town. So you're looking at like a 9-hour plus, yeah. You know, the transfer. I mean, all the different elements that go into that. It's a full day for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I hurt my back and could only train arms 4 times per week. I added 1 inch to my arms. Nice. Very nice. Now, how do I train to keep those gains?
Yeah, it's interesting. At some level, I feel like it may be easier to keep them than you think, just because once you build it, it's easier to maintain it. But at the same time, you only have so many recovery resources to put in place. And so if you're going to go back to training hamstrings and quads and chest and back and shoulders and basically the whole plethora of body parts, you are going to have to at some level sacrifice some of what you gain there to allow the other muscle groups to grow. We just only have so many resources available. And so my thought would be, if you really want to keep them, do a lot less of the other stuff. So maybe you put all those other muscle groups on maintenance and you put all of your effort into training your arms to keep that 1 inch. That would be one viable approach that I think would work. But I think practically, I don't think anybody really wants to just keep their arms 1 inch bigger than maybe they naturally should be and keep from growing everything else when everything else is actually what's going to make you a bigger, more hypertrophic human. So I think you'll likely keep some of it. I'd say somewhere between 30 and 60% is probably something you'll be able to keep by continuing to train your arms with somewhat higher volumes and still train and progress everything else. But I do think it's probably unrealistic to think that you're going to keep that entire inch while going back and training the rest of your body as intensely as you need to.
Yeah. It's kind of like the time I really focused my calves and trained them like 6 days per week and they grew. But then when I stopped training them like that, they pretty much went back to before.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, last question here on the docket is, would it be ideal to train 7 times a week if there were no recovery issues?
I mean, so the way that I initially thought to answer this question is like, you could, if you were going to do quite low volumes across each day, right? If you're going to really distribute that volume and maybe only train for like 35 minutes per day, like you could. If you're someone who just like really likes to go to the gym every single day and what needs to get out of the house, like you could do that. I don't think it would be optimal, however. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Brian?
Yeah, I agree. You know, Menno Henselmans trains this way. And so I always, when people ask this question, he's always the person I think about because he trains full body 7 days a week. And he just does 2 sets per muscle group per day. And over the course of 7 days, that's 14 sets per muscle group. And that's within the 10 to 20 sets needed for growth optimally. And for him, I think it's as much of a mental thing as it is, you know, physical. He just really needs that routine to show up and do the work each day. For me, you know, I've talked about this, I've tried training 6 days a week in my recent bro split. And psychologically, I burned out. It wasn't physically that I was doing too much volume. It was literally that I just didn't want to be in the gym that many days because I was working hard each day. So my thought would be that if you're training 7 times a week, it needs to either be like kind of low volume, like Aaron said, kind of the way Menno Henselmans is doing it, 2 sets per muscle group per day type thing, or you need to have like heavy light days. So I think that that's maybe one way of approaching it is every other day is like a heavy day with some more demanding, fatiguing movements. And then the days in between are maybe more isolated movements with short overload so that there's less crossover fatigue or something along those lines. I still struggle to think that it's optimal. And one of the things that Cass always says, and I've heard Berto reiterate this a bunch of times too, is that hypertrophy game is the game of over recovery. So in that, what I take from that is that you would almost be more benefited by doing too little than by accidentally doing too much, because if you can't recover, you can't grow. And so it's better off to ensure 100% that you're recovered and get the most out of your training that way than to push the boundaries and maybe be under recovered. And then the other thing I'll add to that is that you might feel recovered in the beginning of a mesocycle when you are pretty fresh and maybe you're not pushing everything all the way to failure. But when you get into week 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of a cycle and you've progressed every movement or majority of movements and you're bumping up against failure on a lot of things, you might find that recovery curve changes at that point compared to where it was in the 6 weeks prior.
Yeah. I think I don't think it's optimal at all. If you're like, I guess I'll change my answer. If you're someone who just wants to go to the gym, like have your cardio days, like technically, I shouldn't even say technically, I'm in the gym 7 days per week right now, but 3 of those days, 2.5 are cardio days, right? I'm in there 7 days per week, but I just, like Brian said, I don't think it'd be far from optimal. You'd be doing yourself a disservice on some of those sessions just to move it over to the extra day, and your recovery would be far from optimal.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. All right, cool. Well, that's it. That's all we got.
That's it. That's it for April Q&A. Guys, we'll talk to you next week. As always, thanks for listening. Have a great week. Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at drakernutritionco.com, and more from Brian at evolvedtrainingsystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.